righty, it's time once again for Truth About Markets London with Max and Stacy on Residence 104.4, 60 golden minutes of truth and stuff. Truth and stuff. Truthfulness and stuff like that with your Cornish pasty. You know, we haven't played the Cornish pasty song in a while on the show, and basically because I don't really have an internet connection while doing the show as I did a few months ago, so we don't play the music that we used to, but that's okay. We're constantly evolving, constantly mutating, I would say. You know, mutations are the spice of life. And when you're eating a Cornish pasty, keep that in mind, especially the chicken and mushroom. Stacy?
Honey, but you have to know that the official thing about Cornish pasties is that they're officially, they're only that mutton or meat. They're not chicken. Chicken is not an official Cornish pasty.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you didn't know that, man?
The intricacies of the pasty business are beyond my scope at the moment, but we have folks in Cornwall who are avid followers of this show who we would like to say hello to you. We support your revolutionary movement, your secessionist movement. We support your breakaway movement.
I think all individuals should break away from all governments. Let's let all these governments just, form their own little club. Because we're tired of them representing us. Like, why do we have to choose somebody to represent us when they give us the choice of either somebody like Tony Blair or you know, David Cameron? And they're like the same person.
Well, they don't represent us. You know, that's the problem. I mean, Obama doesn't represent the people. He campaigned on a brilliant campaign of representation of the people, that he was a politician who was a believer in representational government, but he is not that politician. He is a continuation of the past 20 years of a corporocracy, and he represents the interests of the corporations, which brings me to my question of the moment, Stacy.
Oh, Maxie, tell me, Maxie.
This whole thing in the U.S., I'm so sick of it. I just want to
get it off your chest before we talk about the U.K. So yeah. What's going on in the U.S.?
You want to talk about the U.K.?
Yeah.
All right, forget the U.S. What's going on in the U.K.?
Well, there's a national disease, and it's a pandemic, and it has not been addressed yet since this financial collapse. And this is this very British, far more than is the case in America, is this addiction to housing bubbles. They're just this, it's a real ugly, ugly sickness. It makes you look worse than somebody stricken by Ebola and measles and mumps together. It's just disgusting.
Well, real estate speculation.
Real estate speculation. And now we're seeing this unfolding disaster in Dubai. And it is all 100% about property speculation.
Mm-hmm.
Entirely. And almost all driven by British speculators, British property developers. And now we're seeing that Dubai World, the largest corporation in Dubai, which is owned by the government, has announced on the day before a one-week holiday. Okay, the Dubai government is just on a one-week holiday until December 6th.
Mm.
An hour before the government shut down, they announced, "Oh, by the way, we're gonna suspend payments on our debt," and then they ran away.
Ooh.
Okay. Now this is over $80 billion
mm-hmm.
in debt
mm-hmm.
that they've called a standstill to payments.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of that over $80 billion, $50.2 billion belongs to UK banks.
Really?
The next biggest exposure is in France with $11.3 billion, and then Germany and United States tied at $10.6 billion each.
Mm-hmm.
So this is obviously part of that property speculation mentality where, this British notion that you can't go wrong with bricks and mortar. I mean, ever since I moved here in 1994, there was no sort of national property bubble mentality ever in America prior to that. So I had never heard of like dinner party conversation around property bubbles. But as soon as I landed in 1994, it was the only thing I heard. I thought it was like a weird, peculiar little British quaint thing. Little did I know it was like a deadly global disease.
Mm-hmm. The British disease of speculation.
Well, that's it. But anyway, so Gordon Brown is now saying that this is, it's the problem's containable. He doesn't see a big problem with Dubai, even though British taxpayer-owned banks like Royal Bank of Scotland have a big exposure to Dubai World. The two biggest banks with, of that $50.2 billion, $17 billion belongs to HSBC,
mm-hmm.
who, remember, was the first to get whacked by the U.S. subprime market.
Mm-hmm.
And the second biggest exposure is by Standard Chartered Bank, another U.K. bank, with $7.8 billion.
Yeah.
So do you have anything to say about Dubai? What do you think about it?
Well, why would we believe what Gordon Brown has to say about this? He's saying that the problem is contained, and he has said this every step of the way, going now back 2 years with the beginning of the credit crunch. And as I said on Russia Today yesterday, this is the beginning of phase two of the credit crunch. Phase two of the credit crunch has officially begun. So we've got the Middle East with over $1 trillion in bad debt that needs to be disclosed, but they have yet to disclose. You've got the United Arab Emirates now, all of the, how many of them are there, six or seven?
I think it's seven.
The seven Emirates are in turmoil, with Abu Dhabi now eyeing these assets in Dubai, and looks like there's going to be civil discord in that country due to this rampant real estate speculation. And Gordon Brown, of course, and his buddies and Darling and whatnot are saying, well, it looks containable, but that's been the line since the beginning of the crisis 2 years ago. They've been completely wrong for 2 years. And we've got the Middle East ready to implode on more credit contraction. You've got the countries in the Eastern Europe, which are still haven't fully imploded the way they're going to implode. And you've got more disclosures yet in the UK and the US banking system. So according to a lot of informed people who put pencil to paper and add up the numbers here, the total amount of credit, which has yet to be disclosed as part of this cycle, is the total devastation. You know, maybe we're halfway through. So you're talking about, depending on how you calculate this, you're talking about another 15 to 20 trillion in bad debts in the global banking system that have yet to be disclosed. And this is going to mean more bank failures, B, more questions about sovereign debt. And you saw this with Iceland, but now they're talking about it about Greece. You know, Greece sovereign debt is looking like it's going the way of Iceland. The Irish sovereign debt is looking horrible. Italian debt's looking horrible. So you've got the Eurozone periphery in the Eurozone looking horrible. And so you've got sovereign debt on the edge. You've got the banks on the edge. And you still have, of course, huge indebtedness in the various populations around the world and corporations that are still straining under the yoke of tremendous amounts of debt. So the debt pile keeps on growing. And the amount of money that was injected into the system over the past 2 years has not triggered any meaningful inflation. The green shoots of housing recovery in the U.S. and the U.K., getting back to the U.K.'s housing market, has been completely artificial. And now that we're back to the deflation of disclosing these toxic debts, you can expect the real estate market, in my opinion, will suffer another leg down. So the UK real estate market is something we've talked about on this show consistently for 4 years. We called the crash 2 years before it happened based on the loans coming out of banks like Bradford and Bingley and Northern Rock were 120% of equity, which were a guaranteed recipe for failure, as it turned out to be. Then you had the predictable dead cat bounce based on the cash injection that came from the government after the initial phase of the crisis. And now the sugar high of that stimulation is worn off, and you're starting to see now the beginning of phase two, which would mean real estate prices around the world start moving lower again, which means the collateral that is used to buttress the bonds around the world, and the mortgage-backed bonds around the world is going to deteriorate. The trend toward delinquencies and foreclosures will accelerate. The trend toward negative equity will accelerate. And the integrity of the global fiat currency fractional reserve banking system will once again come under severe strain. And I'm looking at two things on Thursday and Friday. Stacey, I'm looking at the price of the dollar and the price of gold. What I've noticed about the dollar is that as a go-to safe haven in times of crisis, it seems to be losing its zip. Now, with this Dubai disclosure, there was a move into the dollar for about 3 hours. It did have a nice rally for just a few hours, and by the end of the day, most of that rally had evaporated. Most of the damage done in the gold bullion market lasted for about 3 hours, and most of the damage by the end of the day was finished. So this tells me that even with the disclosure of a massive debt hole emerging in the Middle East, the U.S. dollar as a safe haven currency is not attracting any bids. And this is even in spite of the news of sovereign debt crisis in the Eurozone and other areas that you would think would generate some safe haven flow of cash into the dollar. The dollar just seems very, very weak. So the trends we've been talking about seem pretty much in place. We've said that there will be another leg to the downward crash in the credit market. We said on this show 3 or 4 weeks ago, I believe, if we had to guess where that next crisis would emanate, we said it would be the Middle East. We said that on this show. We said there are various trouble spots. Will it be Eastern Europe? Will it be the Middle East? Those were the top two contenders. I said on the show, I think it's going to be the Middle East. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened. Based on our travels through that region, based on just some, you know, back of the envelope calculating, that was what my conclusion was. And sure enough, that's exactly what we're seeing. And so those trends are in place. The real estate market collapse trend downward is in place. The dollar weakness is in place. The gold strength is in place. And so the primary trends are still in place. The things we've been saying now for a number of years are still on course. There's nothing that's happened now that has diverted me from any of my thoughts over the past 4 years. And having said all that, what I can say at this time is that I was on Russia Today yesterday talking about this, and I noticed they posted the YouTube up on YouTube, and in less than 24 hours, it's got over 20,000 views. Now, in that YouTube, I did say that both Gordon Brown and Alistair Darling were looking kind of, what did I say? I said they were the Beavis and Butthead of the global financial markets, because the Royal Bank of Scotland, which is mostly owned by the UK taxpayer right now, is a huge loser in this Dubai crisis. And of course, did Brown and Darling do any due diligence and look at the books of Royal Bank of Scotland before they cut the deal? It doesn't look like they did. Otherwise, they wouldn't have cut such a lousy deal. Royal Bank of Scotland failed to disclose, or C, they did partially disclose and the government failed to take it seriously, or D, everybody in Whitehall and the City of London is already dipping heavily into the eggnog for the festivities this season and was unable to focus on any of the specifics of the deal. But it's very predictable. Very predictable.
Well, of course, it probably happened after the taxpayer took over the bank, i.e. the so-called private banks, the ones not under state control, transferred their toxic assets to the taxpayer.
Well, that's a good point about the transference of these debts around the, you know, it's a good word to use in this would be carousel. You know, that's a word used in UK a lot, carousel, as it relates to VAT.
The carousel VAT fraud, yeah.
The carousel VAT fraud. Which is a VAT fraud, which is in the UK. But I like the image of the carousel itself. The carousel is a great image because these toxic debts are the reason they don't get disclosed. Is for the point you just make. The banks collude and the debts are carouseled or shuttled from balance sheet to balance sheet just in time to escape scrutiny by the regulators. And I would guess that in the case of Royal Bank of Scotland, yes, before the sale to the government, these debts were maybe not there visibly. But when the sale goes through, oh, magically, there they are as part of a realizing a credit default swap or some contract that was only carried nominally on the balance sheet as a footnote suddenly came into fruition and said, well, we had this obligation and we had to assume this debt. And of course, this means that the equity is not what it should be. You know, speaking of dilution and carousel machinations, man, you know, the banks, in order to get out of this problem, they're going to have to issue more stock. You see Lloyd's of London, they did a rights offering of more stock this week. You know, and
Lloyd's of London, 74% owned by the UK taxpayer, I believe, or very high up there, yeah. Well over 50%.
Right. So this is another thing we talked about on this very show, that dilution is something you don't want to hear. All of the fraud, all of the activities that have been part of this credit collapse basically keeps getting pushed into the next month and the next quarter and the next year until such time as the government has taken over these assets. And then they say, oh, well, you know, we really looked at it closely this time. We found all kinds of liabilities. We're going to have to issue more stock, do a rights offering. And sure enough, Lloyd's of London stock collapsed 34% in an hour because of the need to sell more stock to pay for all these bad debts. And, of course, the UK taxpayer...
Actually, they own 43% of the bank.
Okay. So now the benchmark needed for the taxpayer to the threshold to cross to get back into positive equity has been pushed a little bit further out of reach. And, of course, there's more disclosures to come, and so that's going to be pushed further and further out of reach. And, you know, this idea that, oh, the UK taxpayer is going to be in positive equity is like the pitch you get from a real estate agent, you know, on the high street trying to talk you into buying some ridiculously overpriced flat in Shoreditch, you know, based on an impossible to maintain trend.
But that brings me back to this British disease, because everybody attacks the bankers and the government. But what about the people who are addicted to housing bubbles? And we mentioned Lloyd's, you know, their share price falling by 34% on this rights issue. The UK taxpayer has to buy it. But the fact is that Lloyd's was one of the, you know, the bright spots in the financial banking disaster, because they had been ridiculed for years for being too conservative. But what happened is Gordon Brown forced them to buy HBOS. HBOS was heavily involved in property speculation and subprime mortgages and this entire Ponzi scheme. So, you know, the Brits, by the way, have a long history of like a mental, you know, a national psyche involved in Ponzi schemes. The South Sea Bubble was one of the biggest Ponzi schemes in the world. This only surpassed right now by this global housing Ponzi scheme.
Mm. You know, I think of the times during the Blair tenure when Gordon Brown was at the dispatch box with his big red briefcase that he carted over from the Exchequer, and he pounded his fist, and he talked about how the UK economy was in surplus for the first time in 300 years, or in a surplus that was greater than at any time during the past 300 years. And he would pound his big meaty jab of a codfish oil fist on 300 years. And make it, you know, inside that big red briefcase were billions, hundreds of billions, trillions of dollars of toxic debts, is what he should have been spilling onto the floor of the Commons like a split, you know, herring, the guts, and for all to see that, in fact, it was nothing more than debt that was fueling this and fancy accounting tricks to fuel this so-called growth and surplus. And now the UK population, of course, as they instinctively knew in the deep of their gut, that this was probably too good to be true, and sure enough it is, and sure enough they're paying through the teeth, and sure enough, you know, all those programs that were put in place, private-public partnership schemes and whatnot, are all unraveling, and, you know, they're still going to have to build the roads and the hospitals and the railway system from scratch and the taxpayers' expense anyway. None of it worked, did it, because of Gordon Brown's flagging belief in the tenets of neoliberalism. You know, he is a disciple of Alan Greenspan. He was there when Alan Greenspan got his knighthood in Britain. And unfortunately, that ideology, as Greenspan himself has said before Congress, was flawed. You know, he should go back to London and give back his knighthood, because he was given that knighthood under a false premise.
By the way, it's unconstitutional for a government, U.S. government employee to accept a knighthood. But obviously, it would be unconstitutional if the Federal Reserve were a government body, but most people think it is. So that should have been the trick. That should have been the evidence right there, the indicator to the population that there was going to be something going amiss. But you talk about the cost of this, and there's another headline in the FT which reads, "Taxpayers face a generation of pain." So, you know, most of our audience out there is that generation that will be paying for this. It says, "The result of the fiscal stimulus in almost every group of 20 economy has been the rise of deficits to levels never seen in peacetime." That's evidence, by the way, of a war against you. Debt so high, so I think they're wrong in saying it's peacetime. I don't think it's peacetime. I think it's war.
That's right.
Debt so high, there is not the ammunition to fight another economic war and a bill to clean up the mess that will be felt by taxpayers for a generation to come. The latest estimates by the IMF show that advanced countries' deficits averaged 1.9% of a national income before the crisis started in 2007, and this year are expected to hit 9.7%.
Yeah, well, by ammunition, of course, they are referring to monetarism and debasement of interest rates to stimulate. And since they bring interest rates, have brought rates down to near zero as part of the global zero interest rate policy, or ZIRP, there's no more room to lower rates. But, friends, Romans, countrymen, this is not true, for there is a policy that will visit us in the near future that some will consider to be shocking. It is, of course, negative interest rates. It's been tried before, historically. Basically, what it means is that instead of the bank paying you an interest to keep your money at their bank, you pay the bank an interest rate to keep your money at their bank. This will be the recourse attempted by Bank of England and the Federal Reserve Bank and other central banks as a way to spur lazy consumers who are not consuming enough and not able or not willing to allow more of the state and corporate debt burden to be transferred to them so that they can pay off the state and the corporation's debt with their menial minimum wage jobs in the sweatshop known as UK-US Western economic corporate corporocracies, where all of the high-paying jobs are continuing to bleed. Even these high unemployment numbers in the States, Stacey, that show real unemployment at 17.5%. Even when you factor in that the trend is moving up quite sharply, it still masks the fact that of the jobs that are around, there is another insidious trend of loss of any kind of meaningful manufacturing job and the rise of meaningless part-time service-related jobs. And so the rising unemployment number is actually worse than it looks, because the quality of the jobs remaining is also degrading at the same time. And so this brings us to my primary description of the global economy in 2009 and going forward 2010, the casino gulag model. I believe going forward that this is the model. We're seeing it evolve right now, Stacey.
Oh, tell us how you're seeing it evolve right now.
Well, as I pointed out on the show before, the casino gulag model, on the gulag side, you see that clearly evolving. You've got loss of wages, loss of jobs, loss of housing, loss of rights, loss of human rights, loss of civil rights, loss of freedoms, the public domain, the public space, the increase in surveillance, the increase in the police state, the increase in totalitarianism and totalitarianism light in the UK or the US. So you see the gulag happening. On the casino side, you're going to see more and more of the internet be transformed into gambling hall, and the Wall Street games that they play in the global casino and the institutional side of the things will be parsed and broken down and made available to the retail investor and retail person and retail surfer. And we're going to see a huge event in 2010 that will herald the official dawning of the casino gulag economy. My understanding, and I read this in Financial Times yesterday, is that Hollywood, some Hollywood studio is planning for a big Hollywood motion picture about the founding of Facebook. So the founder of Facebook, Mark Zuckerman,
and Zuckerberg,
and his rise from student at Harvard to billionaire in just a few years, thanks to Facebook, will be immortalized in a Hollywood film, and that this film will coincide with an initial public offering of Facebook stock. And Facebook stock already has an unofficial capitalization on the private markets of around $10 billion. By this time next year, or by the fall of next year, it'll probably be double or triple that number as the hype associated with this Hollywood film. And I believe, and I'll make this prediction, nobody has yet said this. I want to be the first in the world to say this and to make this late-breaking prediction here on Resonance 104.4, London's premier music station and talk, alternative talk station, that Facebook people will make available to heavy Facebook users some stock on this initial public offering based on your usage of Facebook. So, for example, they have a game on Facebook called Farmville. It attracts 60 million users. It by itself is worth $1 billion if it were trading independent. The heavy users of Farmville, and of course they trade in real dollars because, for example, if you want to open a chicken coop on Farmville, you have to buy the coop for $3. And then you get the virtual chickens and they lay eggs and you have a virtual farming thing going on. And if you want to raise raspberries on Farmville on Facebook, you have to buy fertilizer and things like that. So you're spending real money. It's a real economy. It's a multi-billion dollar virtual economy we've been talking about for years. It's been very interesting to me, you know, studying this for the past 10 years. And so I believe that Facebook will give heavy users of Farmville and other virtual experiences the ability to buy into the initial public offering of Facebook. And this will drive traffic to Facebook as part of the casino and the gulag. See that we know the gulag's evolving, and this is the casino part evolving. So you're gonna have people a year from now, 2 years from now, sitting in their home, jobless, unable to afford food, living in a quasi-totalitarian state, growing virtual raspberries and chickens on Facebook Farmville to make $2 to buy a can of beans. Now, they're free to do all that. There's no policeman standing on the street, but there is a policeman in your computer monitoring everything you do. There is a policeman monitoring all of your transactions and everything you do, your GPS, your RFID tag, your Google locator service. So you will be living in a version of the Matrix in a way. You know, the Matrix is really a very powerful metaphor for this idea that the inhabitants of the casino gulag economy are the batteries that are going to be driving the profits of the owners of Facebook and Twitter and Google and the virtual worlds. Second Life will probably go public as well and use a similar model where your Linden dollars, which is the virtual currency on Second Life, will be convertible into Second Life stock. And that stock will be trading on the exchange. And people will be trading on the exchange, and in a way that's tantamount to gambling, because you know if your holding period is less than a year on the stock market, you're gambling. And if you want success in the stock market, and you look at the successful stories like Warren Buffett, his holding period is, as he says, forever. So you're going to have this mania. It could drive NASDAQ higher as part of the mania. Could drive stock markets nominally higher as part of the mania. It will drive gold higher because older economies in around the world and older wealth around the world will look at this aghast and say, get me into gold as a reaction to this insanity. And
well, speaking of gold and civilization and fair value and all that stuff, there's a really interesting piece that we have posted to maxkaiser.com, and it's by Ambrose Evans Pritchard. And he talks about a warning from Stephen Jen. Remember, he used to be head of sovereign wealth funds for Morgan Stanley. And he now runs a hedge fund, Blue Gold Capital. And he's warning all those people who think gold is in a bubble. And remember, he's a Asian expert. And he says that the gold story essentially is that the rising economic powers of Asia, the Middle East, and the commodity bloc are rejecting Western fiat currencies. China, India, and Russia have all been buying gold on large scale over recent months. So he's saying, why should this purchase of gold stop as the AAA club of sovereign debtors is pushing towards the danger threshold of 100% of GDP? Now, he also points out that all these new players, China, India, Russia, and the Middle East and the commodity blocks, they account for almost all of the accumulation of foreign exchange reserves. So he crunched the numbers, and he found that Mr. Stephen Jen found that the share of gold in the reserves of these countries is just 2.2% compared to 38% in the old world. Or as Ambrose Evans Pritchard says, perhaps we should just call them deadbeats now, the old world. These emerging economies would have to buy $115 billion of gold. Now remember, the 200 tons that India bought just 3 or 4 weeks ago was $6.7 billion.
Mm-hmm.
So they would have to buy $115 billion at the current prices, which is 1,172, just to raise their bullion to 5%. To raise it to half of what the Western levels are, they would have to spend $700 billion at current prices. But he keeps on pointing out current prices because he says as soon as they bought it, of course, it would start to rise even into the stratosphere.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, he's saying that it's a massive shift in civilizations. We're at the moment of a paradigm change. None of your charts will tell you anything because it's a shift. It's a fundamental shift in what is going to be happening.
Yeah. You know, the numbers are startling. You know, as we've been saying on this show, since we made Death of the Dollar for television now 4 years ago, the point is that the global derivative markets are in the hundreds of trillions of dollars, and yet the total value of the total world supply of gold bullion is still under $4 trillion. So now as the unwinding of the derivative markets continues, and this Dubai collapse is another example, it's phase two of the credit crunch, phase two of the global unwinding of all the bad debt that's accumulated over the past 20, 30, 40 years, really. It's been accumulating for decades, and it's all unwinding now, and there's no money velocity, and there is no lending, and there is no inflation, and it's deflation is the primary trend, and we're seeing that happen in Dubai. We're going to see it happen in Eastern Europe. And as all those derivatives are broken, you know, 10, 20% of it, let's say, that's left goes into gold bullion. Okay, there's $60 trillion to $100 trillion of the buying power for gold. Okay, let's say not even 1/100th of a percent of that even goes into gold bullion, and you very quickly get to gold at $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 an ounce, $6,000 an ounce. Why not? When you've got stocks on the exchange trading at 100 times earnings, 150 times earnings on companies that with very dubious business models, why would you not believe that the value of something without any counterparty risk in short supply that's worked for 5,000 years might not be trading a lot higher than where it is today?
Ambrose Evans Pritchard asked Stephen Jen what would be the fair value for gold. And he said, quote, Stephen Jen's response is, quote, we have no such concept. So it could be anywhere. So he points out, for example, that China alone accumulated $150 billion in reserves in the third quarter of this year. And that's pushed the total of their reserves to $2.3 trillion. And to put this into context, he notes that China is amassing almost as much each month as the United States has built up over the entire history of the country.
Yeah, well, it's there's going to be, well, this is leading toward a showdown of some sort, because if China can't get the gold, they're going to want something in kind. And what does the U.S. have to offer? I mean, they've got gold in Fort Knox that they could give China. Presumably, they've got 8,000 tons, although that's highly, you know, that's come under a lot of question as to whether they actually hold it there. But, you know, China's just simply not going to go away and say, well, you know, let bygones be bygones. We made a mistake buying all that U.S. debt. You know, let's just be friends. You know, I don't think that's going to be the case. And so the big loser in all this, again, it's got to be the U.S. I mean, they're the ones who ran up the huge debts. But, you know, getting back to the top of the show, what's going on in the U.K.? You know, the U.K. is definitely, as you say, addicted to real estate speculation. They're addicted to this idea of real estate speculation. I mean, that's what it boils down to. Wherever you go around the world, you find Brits speculating on real estate.
Well, yeah, but because they're caught in this hamster wheel, they don't understand that it's all over. And you could see that as we, you know, to conclude with this article about this civilization shift is, and gold is so crucial to it because it's the anti-speculative instrument. It's the anti-fiat currency. And now, you know, the argument is that, oh, well, you know, if China wants the gold and India wants the gold, then these Western old economies are going to sell it to them. But they point out, the article points out that they didn't even use their quota under the Washington Accord in the last 2 years. Ambrose Evans Pritchard says, my own guess is that they too are wondering whether it makes any sense to keep selling metal in order to buy the fiat paper of the bankrupt peers.
Mm.
And he speculates again that maybe the Tories will actually start to accumulate gold once they get back into power.
Well, let's see. Who's actually producing gold these days? Russia, China, right?
China, I think, is the number one producer.
Okay.
But they buy all of their gold.
Right. And see, the total production of gold supply from all the mines output per year only increases gold supply out there by something like 1 or 2% a year.
Well, it's actually decreasing according to GFMS, the gold analyst.
Right.
And this year they said there's actually going to be a little blip up, and that's because of one single mine in Indonesia or Malaysia. I think it's Indonesia, which because of the price of gold, they were able to extract it was worth it for them to get some harder to get gold. But that, they said, is a one-off this year, and then it'll continue to decline next year. So it's actually declining.
And you hit something called peak gold.
Yeah, that's peak gold.
And, you know, contrast that with, let's say, the story people are very used to on Wall Street. Carl Icahn walks into the offices of an investment bank on Wall Street and says, I want to take over a company. I need $1 billion. And then they start to do the deal, and it turns out, oh, you know what? I need $2 billion. No, I need $4 billion.
Yeah.
And they just print $4 billion, and they print it out of thin air, and they create this magical leverage buyout, private equity, phantasmagorical economy based on fruit flies and fairy dust. And that's been going on for decades. Contrast that with the gold market where, oh, you know what? We can only get 1% more this year, and that's it. And we're running out of it at that pace.
Yeah, but the UK, the US, Ireland, France, all these Western economies, they're all crashing. And you can see that in gold, because who's buying the gold? There's these emerging economies, because why? They don't want to hold all their US dollars. And the other one is the wealthy citizens of these rich countries, because whatever, always throughout history, when a empire or a major country collapses, they go after those who have the money, and they start taking their money.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, according to many of these reports, it's via Switzerland, Austria, Italy. You know, there's massive buying of giant blocks of gold, you know, 100-ounce bars, 400-ounce bars. They're wealthy people are buying this and taking the bars home and putting them, you know, burying them in the backyard.
Yeah, that's right. And I've got the GPS coordinates of all these buried gold bars around the world, and I'm going to sell that information.
That might be worth investing in some sort of metal detector that specifically detects gold underground being hidden in blocks.
Well, the entire market capitalization, by the way, here's an interesting statistic, Stacey Sherby. Sherbert?
Did you forget my name or what?
I was thinking, I don't know, Sherbert, Stacy Sherbert, Stacy Sherbert, Peachy Bowl Sherbert. The entire market capitalization of all the gold mining stocks in the world put together is less than Walmart.
Yeah, I saw that chart. That's pretty amazing.
So Walmart is a model of selling bad Chinese stuff at slave-made wage price. That's going out of business as the credit contraction continues to take its toll. And yet it still has a market capitalization, and I believe it is roughly, I haven't looked in the last few weeks, but let's call it $300 billion. That single company has a market cap of between $200 and $300 billion, and yet it's greater than if you added every market cap of Newmont Mining, Goldcorp, Yamana, Barrick Gold, every gold mining company in the world, you added them all together and it would still be less than Walmart.
Wow.
The market cap.
And Walmart destroys your wealth and gold increases it.
Well, yeah. I mean, now you've got, I'll tell you, I'm going to make a quick mention of something here for those who are, you know, actually making investments. You know, we don't usually cover investments as such, but there is an interesting new thing out there. For those who are familiar with GLD, of course, is a exchange-traded fund for gold bullion, very popular. They now, these exchange-traded gold funds have almost 2,000 tons of gold now, which makes them on a par with the top two or three sovereigns in the world.
I remember about 2 or 3 years ago when they were just about passing through 1,000 tons.
Yeah.
They were getting close to it, and everybody was like, ooh, they're major players. That's pretty amazing.
Yep. Then you've got another exchange-traded fund, GDX.
Yeah.
Which are the...
But we have to say, by the way, for GLD, we don't know, like, I'm not sure how audited that is and whether or not they actually own 2,000 tons in a warehouse, like, say, CEF, you know, the Canadian closed-end fund, or, you know, gold money, like, people that actually hold physical gold that is allocated... And audited.
That's right. Good point. Good point. Now, there's also GDX, which is another exchange-traded fund, which is made up of gold mining companies. So if gold price is going up, if you own the miners, they go up more than the actual bullion because they're mining the stuff that's going up. Back in the 30s, the number one performing stock of the 1930s was Homestake Mining in the U.S., for example. It went up quite dramatically during the Depression. And then, now here's the new one. The new one out there just opened 2 weeks ago is called, the symbol is GDXJ. The J stands for Junior.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were talking about this on Financial Sense today.
Yeah. So, now, the thing about it is that when you're... in these stocks, yeah, sure, they're in a great business, the gold mining business, but you don't know about the management. The management might be terrible. They might they might be in an area of the world with political uncertainty. They might be digging in a part of the world that suddenly gets disappears in an earthquake or something. So diversity is the key, and of course, in the junior mining sector, that is, if you're not diversified, you know, that is highly speculative and I would / insanity. But this exchange-traded fund, GDXJ, gives you diversified portfolio of juniors, which is, a handy thing to look at. Having said that, you know, the risk, the beta, if you will, the beta, which is a measure of its volatility versus the market as a whole, I'm sure when it is published, it'll show that it has a, you know, higher beta than GLD, and both of those probably have a higher beta than most other ETFs or sectors out there, probably in my opinion. So you're talking about high beta securities, and if your risk tolerance is anything below no risk tolerance, you know what I'm saying? Like, there's a lot of risk there.
Well, one final note on that is on Financial Sense, their gold expert they interviewed was talking about this and saying the big problem with this is that people are investing in these ETFs, which are the ETFs, for the most part, use options. They mimic the price of the underlying stocks.
Uh-huh.
And he's saying that the gold expert was saying the problem with especially the juniors one is that the capital isn't actually going to the company,
mm-hmm.
which the company needs the capital, which is why it's listed in order to develop new sites.
Yeah. Wow. So the junior executive minor, the executives with the junior miners are probably, not happy about it.
Apparently not. This is what this guy would suggest.
Yeah, because it's a capital intensive business, digging and whatnot. And the cost of capital is not it's cheap because of the interest rate policies around the world, but it's hard to get because banks aren't making loans. So capital is key. And if they have a way to get people interested in this, but it's not flowing to the executives to expand their operations, that's kind of a bummer.
Well, who will like it, of course, is the large miners like Newmont and Barrick, who don't want these juniors to have access to capital because then they get to pick them up on the cheap.
Mm. Well, there you have it. There's all the cross currents there in this particular sector. And just to reiterate the point, if you're buying individual names, you're taking. Now, let me give you a short thumbnail. Appreciation of how risk works in the stock market. 50% of the risk of owning a stock is in the market itself. 25% of the risk is in the sector. And the remaining 25% is the company itself. So, in other words, you could be in a great company in a great sector, but you're in a bear market, so you're going to lose money. You could be in a bull market, and you could be in the right sector, but the individual stock you own stinks, and that's a big risk. It's 25% of your risk profile. You could be in a great company, but a horrible sector. And the sector is suddenly being downgraded because that industry is being underweighted for some reason because of some political event. And that's another huge risk factor. So the ETFs, on balance, you are addressing a big portion of your risk, the 25% associated with individual names, by just focusing on sectors.
Mm-hmm.
So in that way, it is a less risky way to put money to work in various sectors. But as you were talking about, even so, there are a tremendous amount of cross currents and things, yeah, and issues to consider.
But somebody like Jim Poplava, for example, he understands how to read an income statement from one of these juniors. He knows what he's saying. So if you don't have the ability to do that, or the understanding of whether somebody's lying, or if they're putting out information that would suggest that their future doesn't look too bright, it might be difficult to read those, 10Q statements? Or?
Yeah, 10K, 10Q, the quarterly, annual statements from the company. And yeah, Poplava does his homework. I'll say that about him. He reads all this stuff. And his show generally focuses on names that have been looked at pretty closely. And we have always recommended that show, Financial Sense News Hour, as a really good show for somebody who just wants a show based on investments, investing. Whereas this show is more, has also political and cultural.
Plus, we have entertainment value. And now stuff. I want to go back to the UK.
What about John Loeffler? He's entertaining.
That's right.
He makes funny jokes.
Yeah.
Well, Jim.
And they have Steve Dore songs. But back in the UK, Alistair Darling has basically admitted this week that, in fact, the economy is going to shrink by more than anticipated for 2009. So it's actually...
Oh, really?
Yeah, the 2009 GDP decline will ultimately be 4.9% decline.
Wow. Oh, you mean he made a boo-boo?
Well, they were overly optimistic about...
Why? that's the funny thing about it. These government officials think they need to be overly optimistic. That's really terrible. Because all they need to be is accurate. Let people go through their own emotional tribulations. Just give us the real deal, and we'll sort it out on our end. Don't mollycoddle the data, because it gives us emotional problems on our end, because we're dealing with your problems, and it makes our problems much worse because you're getting a government salary and we're not. okay? You're being paid by us to give us accurate data. Just give us the data and shut up. If it's bad data, give us the bad news so we can deal with it. Don't massage the numbers. Don't recalibrate the numbers. And don't put on a happy face and think you're doing us a favor, okay? You're not. You're making our job surviving more difficult by your constant evasiveness and lying, you know, you can't say that directly to their face, per se.
But Max, what about the argument that if we are operating global Ponzi schemes in the Western world?
Yeah.
And I have no doubt that the emerging economies, once they become the superpowers, will operate their own. But right now we have our Ponzi schemes, and a Ponzi scheme is all based on confidence. So if you need to encourage confidence for somebody who's making, you know, 40,000 pounds a year, you need to convince them to take out a 400,000 pound mortgage, that everything will be all right because they'll be able to pay it off even if they're only making 40,000 pounds a year.
Look, people know. Yeah, okay, you're right. I mean, that's true. But the government, the tragedy is that the civil servants, for the most part, are not going to benefit from their Ponzi schemes. They're still only going to get a government salary, which, okay, it's better than no salary and it's going to get a good pension. But they're not really benefiting directly from these Ponzi schemes except in outright cases of fraud. They're just perpetrating the happy talk.
It keeps the population happy, and if somebody takes a 400,000 pound mortgage out on a 40,000 pound salary and zero down, for the most part, they'll suddenly feel like they're worth 400,000 pounds. So they'll feel wealthy. They won't mind if their taxes go up or they're paying taxes toward an increasing government bureaucracy. They don't mind that because they think they're getting rich with the Ponzi scheme.
Okay, so the government is just basically cheerleaders.
Yes, that's right.
That's their only role at the end of the day, is they're just cheerleaders and they have no function other than that.
But for now, until December 6th, yeah, when this Muslim holiday is up, we don't know whether another chair has been taken away from this musical chair event because... You know, so Sheikh Mohammed from Dubai has suddenly announced, like an hour before the government closed down for a week, that we owe the UK $50 billion essentially, and we're going to take a break for a week. But
that's pretty wild, isn't it?
Yeah, but you know, the thing is, if you read all the articles about this, you have to get down to about the sixth or seventh or eighth paragraph, and you find that everybody from Gordon Brown to the CEO of HSBC are saying, we think this is just a short-term thing. We believe that Dubai and the UAE government, i.e. the very wealthy trillionaires running Abu Dhabi, will bail out the situation.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody's waiting for basically Abu Dhabi to open December 6th and tell them, okay, we had this family vacation and... we sorted out our problems. The market, the senior executives are treating it as if it's just a family squabble going on.
Right. That's interesting because they really have been operating like this for many, many years. And they kind of suddenly they don't realize how integrated they are in the global economy that they are. I don't think they understand that. I don't think they understand that everything is connected and that a massive contagion outbreak in the Middle East is going to throw the entire globe into a tailspin.
What, these guys who went away for their, it's like a long new Thanksgiving holiday. You know, they go away for a week, but they don't realize that this little break, that they've left the world hanging on tenterhooks.
Yeah, well, the market is the master, you know. I mean, I think the kings in the Middle East, the rulers, the imams, the emirs, you know, they still think that they're running the show. I think they're still preoccupied with that thought, that delusion. But I think this could be a new thing for them, where they're going to be interrupted on their vacation by these BlackBerry texts saying, we need you to respond to this because the world is blowing up, you know, dude. And they're gonna be like, "Don't you get it? I'm on vacation, and we'll take care of this later." You know, I'm the emir. You're just a peasant. This could be a new thing for them.
Yeah. Well, exactly. When when $3 trillion a day is traded on the forex markets, and you know, business is done differently at a much slower pace in other parts of the world. And
if right. The Arabs have this reputation, don't they? Being very, very slow and methodical, and you got to meet them like 20 times before they do anything. And so they're like, "Oh, we're going away for 6 days. Oh, by the way, we're going to renege on a big debt deal, and it's probably going to throw the global economy into turmoil. We'll see you in 6 days.
Well, no, but the problem is they're not going to renege on it. You know, Abu Dhabi will bail them out, and that will be the case. As many people point out, Abu Dhabi has the biggest sovereign wealth fund in the world, somewhere between $600 billion and $1 trillion. So these mere debts of $80 billion are.
They're not gonna bail them out 100 cents on the dollar.
I don't think so. No.
No. Okay. So they were last trading for what, 70 cents on the dollar.
So basically, the creditors now are going to have to jockey to see who takes the biggest losses. And as Britain has the most to lose, I have a feeling that they're going to get to take the biggest haircut.
Well, it brings us back to the Cornish pasty. We only have about 2 minutes left in the show, and the people in Cornwall are going to be the ones ultimately paying for this Middle East bond catastrophe. And I suggest that they start stuffing their pasties with these Dubai World bonds. Like those Chinese cardboard rice dumplings.
Yeah, and sell those into Chelsea and Mayfair with all the property speculators.
It's just like Sweeney Todd, except instead of using meat of the barber's clients, they use the bonds from the Dubai World collapse. Sold at the pasty shop on Cornwall. You know, somebody sent us a pasty. No, they gave us two pasties once.
That's right.
And I enjoyed it tremendously. I believe one of them was chicken and mushroom, but you're saying that doesn't qualify as an official Cornwallian pasty.
Exactly, but it could have been, it did kind of taste like Celebrity Chef, the other one.
Oh, that guy, what's his name?
Oh, yeah, Gordon Ramsay!
Gordon Ramsay, we're going to talk about him on our next show.
He's involved with this whole Dubai thing.
Oh my God, he is the poster child.
For a national sovereign collapse. Yes.
Oh, my God. You know, when we were in Iceland and we were at Kaupthing Bank, their annual report, who was on the cover?
Gordon Ramsay.
Gordon Ramsay.
Then he was the poster boy of Dubai. And where is the one other place he's a poster boy for?
Vegas?
Yeah, U.S.
Yeah.
The U.S. is, that's our indicator. That's the next sovereign debt collapse, the U.S. Where's after Dubai.
Yeah, where's Gordon Ramsay now? Wherever he is, sell that country short. You can kiss that country goodbye. Gordon Ramsay is the kiss of death for any sovereign country debt. All right, we'll see you next week. Bye, y'all.